Welcome back to the deep dive. If you've ever felt that anxiety spike when someone mentions Form 10K or GAAP compliance, then this deep dive is for you. Today, we are tackling the world of U.S. corporate financial statement filing.
It's a topic that sounds, like pure bureaucracy, but these statements are really the engine, not the exhaust. They're the official record of your business's health. And they're crucial, not just for the IRS, but for building credibility and securing, every dollar of future capital.
Our mission is simple. We want you to stop seeing these filings as just tax forms and start viewing them as the most powerful diagnostic and, frankly, strategic tools you have. We're going to walk through the whole process from figuring out which form to file all the way to using that data to attract investors. Okay, let's unpack this. We have to begin with the basics. Who files what? Because the reporting landscape in the U.S. is, it's totally fragmented based on the legal structure you choose.
That's the foundational point. If you choose to incorporate as either a C corporation or an S corporation, you are signing up for the most comprehensive reporting obligations. These are distinct legal entities from their owners, so they must file their own corporate tax returns.
And what are those specific corporate filings?
So for C corporations, which are taxed separately from their owners and can have unlimited shareholders, they file Form 1120 annually.
Okay.
S corporations, on the other hand, they typically pass their profits and losses directly to the owner's personal returns, so they avoid corporate tax, and they file Form 1120S. The tax treatment is hugely different, but the need for detailed financial reporting, that remains high for both.
Now, what about the LLC, the limited liability company? It's so common now, but it seems to confuse people because it's so flexible. How does an LLC know what to file?
An LLC's filing is almost entirely dictated by its tax selection.
The tax selection.
Yeah. If it's a single member LLC, the default is to be treated as a sole proprietorship. That means you file using Schedule C on your personal Form 1040.
Ah, okay.
If it has multiple members, it usually files as a partnership using Form 1065.
Yeah.
It's only if the LLC owners actively elect to be taxed as a corporation that they'd switch over to the 1120 or 1120S forms.
So let's say I run a small private C corp. I'm not publicly traded. I don't really need to worry about the big scary NAP standards.
Right. Not necessarily for your external reporting, no. But you absolutely have federal requirements baked right into your tax return itself. This is a common stumbling block for private companies.
Really?
Yeah. Even if you don't use GAAP generally accepted accounting principles for your internal books, you still have to complete two specific schedules with your federal return, Schedule L and Schedule M1.
Okay, can you explain those? They sound very technical.
Schedule L is essentially a mandated balance sheet. It captures the company's assets, liabilities, and equity at the beginning and end of the tax year.
Got it.
Schedule M1 is critical. It's the reconciliation of income. It exists because the income you report to, say, your shareholders, your book income, often differs from the income you report to the IRS, your taxable income.
Why would they differ? Can you give an example?
Sure. The rules are just different. For instance, you might use straight-line depreciation for your financial statements, but for tax purposes, you use accelerated depreciation to get a bigger deduction sooner. Schedule M1 makes sure the IRS can clearly track those differences and see exactly how you got to your final taxable income number. It's a key audit tool for them.
This is where it really gets interesting, though. The publicly traded companies, they operate in a completely different universe of rigor.
Oh, absolutely. That's where we see the most stringent requirements. Public corporations have to follow the rules of the Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC. They file a Form 10-Q quarterly, which is a quick, unaudited summary, and then the massive, detailed, audited annual report, Form 10-K.
And the regulatory burden that comes with that is just intense, especially since Sarbanes-Oxley or SOX was enacted.
Precisely. SOX was all about restoring investor trust. It mandates that executive officers have to personally certify the quality of the company's internal financial controls.
So the CEO and CFO are on the hook personally.
Exactly. It ensures the systems recording the money are sound, making it much harder to commit fraud. For a public company executive, SOX compliance is a major ongoing operational cost and, frankly, a legal risk.
And before we move on, we have to mention that state requirements are that final layer of complexity.
They add a huge amount of variability. Most states require annual reports listing officers and directors, sure, but many also impose franchise taxes.
And those aren't always based on income.
No. Sometimes they're calculated on metrics like your total capital structure or your gross receipts within that state. It means accurate financial record keeping is vital even for state-level compliance.
Okay, so we've covered who reports. Now let's talk about the reports themselves. When we say financial statements, we're really talking about four core documents that together tell the complete story.
Right. We start with the income statement, which everyone knows is the P&L profit and loss. This statement is like a movie of your performance. It summarizes your revenues and expenses over a specific period, a month, a quarter, a year, to show if you were profitable.
Can you walk us through that flow from the very top line down to the bottom?
Of course. We start with gross revenue, all the money from sales. Then you subtract the cost of goods sold, or COGS, the direct costs of making those goods or services. And that gives you gross profit. This number tells you how efficient your core production process is.
And then we get into the operating costs.
Correct. You subtract operating expenses. This is usually things like SG&A selling, general and administrative costs. Think marketing, rent, salaries, plus depreciation. That brings us to operating income, often called EBIT.
Why is EBIT earnings before interest and taxes so important for analysis?
It's the great equalizer. EBIT tells you how healthy the core business is before you factor in how the company is financed, so interest expense, or where it operates, which is taxes.
So lenders must love that number.
They do. Lenders focus on EBIT because it shows them the operational capacity to repay debt, no matter what the company's current tax or debt situation is. After interest and taxes, you finally get to net income, the bottom line.
So if the P&L is the movie, the balance sheet is the definitive snapshot.
Exactly. The balance sheet must always, always adhere to that fundamental equation. Assets equal liabilities plus shareholders' equity. It's a precise picture of what a company owns and what it owes at one single point in time.
And the way it's organized, the classifications within that sheet are key for assessing liquidity, aren't they?
They absolutely are. Assets are broken down into current assets. Things like cash, accounts receivable, inventory, stuff you expect to turn into cash within a year, and non-current assets, mainly property, plant, and equipment, or PP&E. Long-lived assets. Liabilities follow the same structure. Current liabilities, like accounts payable, versus long-term liabilities, like mortgages or bonds.
But I've often heard investors say the most important statement of all is actually the third one, the statement of cash flows. Why is that?
Because it cuts through all the accounting estimates and shows you the cold, hard reality of cash. You can't pay your employees with net income. You need cash. This statement tracks where cash came from and where it went, and it organizes it into three crucial activities.
Operating, investing, and financing. How do we tell those apart?
Operating cash flow is the simplest. It's the cash from your core day-to-day business. Investing activities show money spent on or gained from long-term assets, like buying a new factory or selling old equipment. And financing activities track deals with owners and creditors, issuing stock, taking out loans, paying dividends.
And finally, the part that so many people skip over but our source material says is integral, the notes to financial statements.
These are so essential. They aren't supplementary. They are the narrative context for the numbers. They explain the specific accounting policies you're using, like how you value inventory. They detail significant estimates like how you value goodwill.
So it's where all the details are hidden.
All of them. If you're looking at long-term debt on the balance sheet, the notes will have a schedule showing the specific maturity dates and interest rates for every single loan. Without the notes, the numbers are incomplete.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Let's focus on the common pitfalls, the landmines that trip up even profitable businesses and can cost an owner everything.
And we have to start with the cardinal sin, especially for new business owners, mixing personal and business finances.
It seems so easy to do, just using the company card for groceries. Why is that so dangerous?
Because it jeopardizes your entire limited liability protection. If a court decides you haven't kept a clear separation, a concept called commingling funds, they can pierce the corporate veil.
And that means?
It means your personal assets, your house, your car, your savings, suddenly become vulnerable to business debts and lawsuits. The solution is simple, but vital. Dedicated accounts, pay yourself a clean salary, and document every single transfer.
Okay, mistake number two, lack of backup documentation. It sounds tedious, but this is where tax deductions so often fail.
Audits always come down to the paper trail. If you claim a deduction for business travel, the IRS requires strict records. You need to show the amount, date, place, purpose, and the business relationship. We see so many businesses lose legitimate deductions just because they didn't keep the receipt or jot down the purpose of the meeting at the time.
Let's talk depreciation. This is complex, and I think it's often miscalculated.
It's a critical concept. Depreciation is just an accounting method that allocates the cost of a big asset, like a $50,000 machine, over its useful life, say, 7 years.
So you don't take the whole hit in year one.
Exactly. You deduct a portion each year. Failing to calculate it or using the wrong statutory life for an asset distorts your true profits and causes tax errors. And you also have to decide, are you using standard depreciation or an accelerated method like Section 179 expensing?
A fourth major pitfall, one that gets huge IRS scrutiny, is worker misclassification.
This is a high-risk area. It's tempting to classify workers as independent contractors to save on payroll taxes. But if the IRS determines they should have been an employee, the consequences are enormous.
And how do they decide that?
It's a multi-factor test looking at behavioral control, financial control, and the type of relationship. If you lose, you're liable for all the back taxes, penalties, and interest on the employer side of Social Security and Medicare you should have been withholding.
Let's switch to the compliance calendar. The business world runs on tight deadlines, and the IRS, well, they don't forgive delays.
That's absolutely true. You have to know your structure and your deadlines. For C corporations, it's Form 1120 by the 15th day of the fourth month after your year end, so usually April 15th. S corp, because their profits flow through to owners, have an earlier deadline, the 15th day of the third month, or March 15th for most.
And if you need more time, you can file an extension with Form 7004, but there's a really important rule about payments that people often miss.
This is the most important compliance rule there is. Form 7004 gives you an extension to file the paperwork. It is not an extension of the time to pay your taxes.
So you still have to pay up.
You have to estimate your tax liability and pay at least 90% of it by the original deadline, March 15th or April 15th, to avoid penalties and interest.
And for corporations that expect to owe more than $500, they also have to manage estimated payments.
Yes. Corporations must pay estimated taxes quarterly. Those payments are due on the 15th day of the 4th, 6th, 9th, and 12th months of the tax year. Miss those, and you can get underpayment penalties, even if you pay in full with your annual return.
And if you do miss that main filing deadline, what are the costs?
They escalate fast. The IRS penalty for late filing is generally 5% of the unpaid tax for each month it's late, up to 25%. If you're over 60 days late, the minimum penalty jumps to $435 or 100% of the unpaid tax, whichever is less. And at the state level, repeated noncompliance can lead to administrative dissolution.
Which means your liability protection is just gone.
Instantly gone. Your personal assets are exposed again.
All right, let's shift gears completely. How do we move from seeing these statements as a painful compliance checklist to a powerful tool for management and growth?
It's all about realizing they are the language of capital. When you go for financing, a commercial lender is going to demand 3 years of financial statements because they are focused entirely on one thing, risk. They need proof you can repay the loan.
What are the key metrics a bank immediately zeroes in on?
They look hard at liquidity and leverage. The current ratio, your current assets divided by current liabilities, needs to be healthy. Ideally, 1.5, 2.0 or higher. It shows you can cover short-term debts.
Okay.
They also scrutinize the debt-to-equity ratio. But the most critical metric for them is the debt service coverage ratio, or DSCR.
Tell us more about DSCR.
DSCR takes your available operating income and divides it by your required annual debt payments. If a lender sees a DSCR of, say, 1.25, it means your operating income is 125% of what you need to make those payments.
So a higher number is better.
Much better. A high, consistent DSCR means you get lower interest rates and better terms.
And equity investors, like venture capitalists, they look at this data through a totally different lens than a bank.
Completely different. A bank wants security. An equity investor wants growth and scalability. So they're focused on things like gross margins and revenue growth rates. For startups, where net income might even be negative, they obsess over the burn rate, how quickly the company's eating through its cash to achieve that growth.
I would imagine that if you're trying to raise a serious amount of capital, your own internal statements aren't going to cut it.
That's correct. For any significant external investment, JAP-compliant audited statements become non-negotiable. An audit provides that third-party assurance that your numbers are fairly presented. It massively increases investor confidence.
And let's touch on the future. How is technology changing all of this?
Well, cloud-based accounting is already standard. But AI is the real game changer. AI is taking over the tedious tasks. Data entry, categorization, reconciliation. This shifts the role of the accountant from a data processor to a high-value strategic advisor. Someone focused on interpreting the data to help management make better decisions.
And we're also seeing a huge push for reporting that goes way beyond just dollars and cents.
That's the emerging importance of sustainability reporting, or ESG, environmental, social, and governance. Right now, Regulation is mostly targeting big public companies, but stakeholder pressure is increasing everywhere. Smart private companies are already starting to proactively measure their carbon footprint and supply chain ethics because they know these disclosures will soon be critical for attracting certain investors and partners.
This deep dive has really covered the full spectrum, from the specific IRS form you need, all the way to using those records to shape your company's future. The fundamental takeaway seems to be that rigorous, consistent record keeping isn't just about avoiding penalties. It's about unlocking opportunity.
This raises an important question. While the income statement is essential because it shows profitability, your net income, it is absolutely crucial for listeners to internalize that profitability and cash flow are two very different concepts.
So you can be a success on paper, but a failure in reality.
Exactly. A business can show a strong net income and still go bankrupt because of a liquidity crisis. If you make a massive sale, but you give the client 120 days to pay, your P&L looks great, but you don't have the cash on hand to make next week's payroll. So you must continuously monitor your working capital metrics, especially the current ratio and your day's sales outstanding. You have to do this to make sure your business stays liquid and solvent even during your most aggressive growth periods. That constant analysis of liquidity, that's the key insight for long-term sustainability.